It's 1793. The capital of the U.S. is Philadelphia, a growing city that is a hub for politics, science, and trade. Think lots of tanneries and breweries, industry, merchants, horses, people going around doing their work. And in the sweltering heat of the summer months, residents in this young city complain about the refuse from all of that activity. Waste and animal carcasses.
Swarms of mosquitoes buzz about. Refugees from the Haitian Revolution have poured into the city of about 55,000 inhabitants, and a devastating illness starts to spread.
Jaundice of the eyes, jaundice of the skin, so everything looks yellow.
People are dying so fast. People describing symptoms in the morning and being dead in the afternoon.
Vomiting blood, blood in the stool.
Yellow fever has returned to the city after a 30-year break.
My husband informs me of the death of Reuben Haynes Sr., who died this morning rather suddenly. Many have gone off within these few days.
He describes the image of seeing a carriage going around with no driver, just a dead body laying across the seat.
One of the big misconceptions from the beginning is that black people are immune.
Those who can flee run from the city. Those who stay panic.
There's just incredible fear and the idea that at any minute you could get it. Do they look a little yellow? Is my eye yellow? Is my eye yellow?
The yellow fever epidemic of 1793 decimated the city's population.
It was mayhem.
It challenged the city's health and political infrastructure.
Bury the dead, nurse the dying.
'Tis really an alarming and serious time.
Responding to this crisis became political, and its aftermath brought important changes and public health policies.
This is the beginning of public health.
I'm Maiken Scott, host of the health and science show The Pulse at WHYY.
And I'm Mike Udell, public health historian at the Dornsife School of Public Health at Drexel University.
How did the nation survive this major outbreak? How did things change in response? We're going to visit different locations in Philadelphia that played an important role in this story. Our first stop is Alfred's Alley. This is the oldest continuously inhabited residential street in the United States. And this quaint alleyway is the perfect place to walk around and imagine what life was like for early Philadelphians on the eve of the yellow fever epidemic.
This city was built around a maritime economy. Ships coming and going to the Delaware River port, bringing wares. And this whole area was dense with buildings and people.
As you move closer to the water from 8th and Market, the more there are these little alleys. Behind the little alleys, there are little courtyards with multiple buildings, with multiple families that are living in them.
That is architectural historian Emily Cooperman. Many of the buildings you see had shops on the first floor with residents above. You see these large front windows? Picture cobblers and seamstresses at work.
And the sounds of commerce in your ears. People hawking their wares on the streets, the clip-clop of horse-drawn carts.
You would have heard the sounds, if you listened carefully, of very large sails flapping in the breeze.
Multiple families lived together in the small apartments above the shops. There was no electricity and no indoor plumbing.
There was an outhouse behind each of these houses, and that would have been the primary sanitary facility. And then water would have been provided by wells, which also would have been in the backyard. And one of the things that you don't see today is that you don't see the dirt and the garbage.
You need to imagine this place just stinking to the high heavens.
And the horse manure and the cow manure that would have been on the street in 1793, that was called street dirt.
And as the yellow fever epidemic of 1793 breaks out, for the folks who lived here, panic sets in. Who will get sick next?
Reuben Haynes Sr.
David Salisbury Franks.
People here in this little alleyway had no way out. The city's wealthy fled to country retreats along the Schuylkill River.
That was really a privilege of the few. The residents of Alfred's Alley who couldn't afford to go away and get out of the city were stuck here.
Stuck in the dirt and the filth of the street and the cramped quarters of their houses. And now death is moving swiftly among them.
Many have gone off within these few days.
The Diary of Elizabeth Drinker, a Quaker woman who lived nearby, offers a glimpse into the anxiety.
Benjamin Wilson continues very low, is again blistered.
And as people are dying, fear and rumor spread. What is causing this disease? What or who is to blame?
Some say it was occasioned by damaged coffee and fish, which was stored at William Smith. Others say it was imported in a vessel from Cape Francois, which lay at our wharf, or at the wharf back of our store. 'Tis really an alarming and serious time.
Our next stop is Dock Street. This is the place where many believed the epidemic started. Today, Dock Street has cobblestones, pedestrians walk around, but right here used to be a creek.
And the creek had tides and slowed to a trickle in the summer months. Trash accumulated in the water, and many residents thought this could be a potential source of the disease that was taking over the city.
As August gives way to September, yellow fever claims more and more lives in Philadelphia. The symptoms are flu-like at first.
Fever, headache, muscle aches.
That's infectious disease specialist Esther Chernak. For some people, that is it. They get better. But for others, it only seems like they're better at first.
One of my patients stood up and shaved himself on the morning of the day he died.
They get up, they shave, they do what they're going to do, and then a small percentage of those folks, about 15%, are going to become much, much, much sicker.
The kidney and liver begins to fail. They bleed internally.
Vomiting blood, blood in the stool.
Panic is sweeping the city, and everybody wants to know, where is this disease coming from? And that's why we wanted to take you to this location.
Well, the cobblestone street here follows more or less exactly the course of the original course of the creek.
That's David Barnes, Associate Professor of History and Sociology of Science at the University of Pennsylvania.
It was certainly a very busy part of the city. There was a lot of commercial activity. So it's relatively quiet here now. This is a pedestrian street, so there are no cars driving by. And I think it would have been quite a bit noisier in 1793.
And this creek was just foul. People had been complaining about it for years.
Dock Creek was described as a receptacle for the carcasses of dead dogs and other carrion and filth of various kinds, which laying exposed.
In 1793, people had many theories about the origins of disease. Nobody is looking through microscopes yet.
There's no germ theory of disease. There's no sense that there are living microorganisms spreading disease from one person to another or from the water or from food.
Instead, doctors observe what was happening and try to puzzle things together. With yellow fever, people are generally falling into two camps.
The first believe that epidemics were imported to cities like Philadelphia from overseas.
And there was a very busy commercial traffic between Philadelphia and various ports in the West Indies. Lots of traffic back and forth every day.
The epidemic also coincides with an influx of refugees fleeing the slave rebellion in Haiti. But on the other side of the debate, prominent Philadelphia physician Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, makes a different point.
Rush and his allies insisted that yellow fever could not be spread from person to person.
The fever has assumed the most alarming appearance. It not only mocks, in most instances, the power of medicine, but it is spread through several parts of the city.
Instead, they argued that yellow fever starts in places like this, right here.
It was spread through the air and through the emanations from accumulations of filth in the city.
This was often called a miasma, which were foul smells that traveled through the air that people at the time thought could cause disease.
It is supposed to have been produced by some damaged coffee, which has putrefied on one of the wharves.
There was also a political dimension to the medical debate. All this talk about filth in Philadelphia.
those who believed that yellow fever was imported and contagious considered that an insult to the reputation of the city of Philadelphia.
But those who blamed dirt and stench, they insisted the country and the city needed work and improvements.
Cleaning up the filth in the streets was simply one of the most urgent of many longer-term improvements that were necessary for the development of this young nation.
The yellow fever epidemic continues to claim lives. Many doctors flee the city, but Benjamin Rush stays behind and is devoted to caring for his patients, and also to see his approach to dealing with yellow fever carried out.
From 10 to 20 grains calomel with an equal quantity of jalap are a dose. The patient should drink plentifully of chicken water or water gruel and lie in bed during the operation of the physic.
Benjamin Rush's house stood right in the epicenter of the yellow fever epidemic at 3rd and Walnut. He was well known in the city.
Rush was politically connected to the most powerful men in the country, active in all kinds of civic debates and causes.
The most important doctor in Philadelphia at a time when Philadelphia was the most important city in the country.
That's Stephen Fried, the author of Rush, Revolution, Madness, and the visionary doctor who became a founding father.
In the late summer of 1793, Rush and other physicians begin to see the first cases of the outbreak. Rush had seen yellow fever before when he was a young man, and now he recognizes the symptoms.
The eyes are at first suffused with blood. They afterwards become yellow.
He writes to his wife Julia, who is in Princeton with the couple's children.
My dear Julia, to prevent your being deceived by reports respecting the sickliness of our city, I sit down at a late hour, and much fatigued, to inform you that a malignant fever has broken out in Water Street, between Arch and Race Streets, which has already carried off 12 persons.
Yellow fever is back, and it could be the worst that they have ever seen.
Many doctors flee from the city, terrified to get sick themselves. But Rush stays, treating patients around the clock.
He just worked like crazy. One of the things about Rush, even the people who hated his guts, and some did, they had to admit he was the hardest working man in American medicine.
Newspapers in the city cover the epidemic at a breathless pace.
You had a huge media in the city, so there were like 6 or 7 daily newspapers, which is almost the equivalent of like the internet bursting out at that time. So media was very, very active, and people were reporting things right away.
Rush and other doctors get advice and tips published. And since many believe the disease is spreading through the air,
they talked about things you could do to prevent the air around you from making you sick. So people thought smoking would help them keep disease away. And they rub themselves with garlic. And one of my favorites was they would soak a rope in tar and then put it around their necks.
Many doctors recommend gentle treatments for the illness, cold or hot baths, wine, or purgatives. At first, Rush seems on board with that lighter touch, but as more and more people are dying,
Rush was like, hey, I did the lighter treatment and it doesn't work. So he was doing this privately and he was moving up to using mercury and to use more bloodletting.
Rush is bleeding patients about 20 ounces at a time, often several times in a row, and purging.
From 10 to 20 grains calomel with an equal quantity of jalap are a dose. The patient should drink plentifully of chicken water or water gruel and lie in bed during the operation of the physic, for it generally sweats as copiously as it purges. It moreover sometimes pukes when it finds bile on the stomach.
His political opponents, like his enemy, Federalist Alexander Hamilton, say Rush's approach is bad and harmful.
When there's no science, politics will take over. So we think that's a modern concept, but in fact, it comes from the very beginning of America. the very beginning of freedom, is freedom to have this ridiculous fight about politics when we don't know the scientific facts. Everything's political. Because in reality, while you have people claiming what I'm doing works, what I'm doing works, in reality, nothing is working.
Still, many Philadelphians think this is their best hope for survival once they fall ill. And the palliative care Rush provides is both physically and emotionally supportive. They recognize Dr. Rush's one-horse carriage that he drives himself.
When he was on the way to house calls, people would reach out to him, please, Dr. Rush, come into my house. Please come do this.
Rush treats everybody, regardless of income, class, or race. And despite, or as some of his political enemies say, because of his tireless efforts, people continue to die. Rush loses his sister to the fever, and he falls ill himself but recovers, and he keeps working.
My dear Julia, 700 have died since the 11th of October. 3,400 have died since the 1st of August. Oh, that God would hear the cries of groans of the many hundred and perhaps thousand sick, which still ascend to his throne every hour of the day and night from our desolating city.
He describes the image of seeing a carriage going around with no driver, just a dead body laying across the seat.
The city is cloaked in smoke and dirt. The smell of death and decay are in the air, and Rush has enlisted the help of his friends in the free black community to alleviate the suffering. This takes us to Mother Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church at 6th and Addison Streets in Philadelphia. The ground this church sits on is believed to be the oldest piece of land in the United States that's been continuously owned by African Americans. That lineage dates back to 1791, when the land was purchased by preacher Richard Allen for the creation of a new independent black church.
But Allen's plans were delayed when the yellow fever epidemic swept through the city. If you were standing right here in 1793, you wouldn't see much.
It was just a piece of land. I don't know what was here, probably just weeds.
That's Reverend Mark Tyler. He's the current pastor at Mother Bethel. Free African Americans played a significant role during the yellow fever outbreak, with two larger-than-life men at the helm.
Richard Allen and Absalom Jones. They met when they were both preaching at St. George's Methodist Episcopal, a church where black and white members worshiped together. The men would become lifelong friends and crusaders against racism in early America.
That fight ratcheted up when the black members of the congregation were forced out. Here's Arthur Sudler. He directs the Historical Society at the African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas. That's the church that was later founded by Absalom Jones.
They came to St. George's, and they were told by the ushers that they needed to take seats in the new balcony over the ones that they had formerly occupied on the first floor.
And here's Reverend Tyler again.
You know, both of them had been enslaved, and I could imagine in their minds that there's no way that after going through all the hell of getting free, that we're going to now subject ourselves to this once again. Your kingdom
come. They decide to build their own churches, but then...
The yellow fever epidemic obviously grips the city with fear. And one of the big misconceptions from the beginning is that black people are immune.
The idea that African Americans as a people would be immune to diseases like yellow fever was rooted in the false and dangerous idea that blacks and whites had fundamentally different vulnerabilities. Jones and Allen would later push back against this idea, writing,
"Happy would it have been for you, and much more for us, if this observation had been verified by our experience. When the people of color had the sickness and died, we were imposed upon and told it was not with the prevailing sickness, until it became too notorious to be denied. Then we were told some few died, but not many. Thus our services were extorted at the peril of our lives."
But as the fever raged, Allen and Jones want to help other Philadelphians. They want to support their longtime friend, Benjamin Rush. Rush is a vocal opponent of slavery, and he's been supportive of the preachers' efforts to build their own churches. And the men heed his call for help.
And they said they went to one home where the parents were dead and the children were left alone and they were orphans. And they went to other homes and they saw similar scenes. And it really brought home to them just how critical it was for someone to step into the breach and to try to help.
Many in the Free Black community work as nurses and gravediggers, burying the dead and taking care of the sick.
They report that they bled over 800 patients applying Dr. Rush's treatments.
Once they realized that, you know, black people are dying at the same rate and that they're not immune, that does not stop them from helping, and they stay in the city and they still help to their own peril.
After the epidemic is over, this heroic story is nearly erased. A well-known writer and publisher at the time, Matthew Carey, writes an account of the disaster fueled by racism, accusing black people of stealing from the dead and dying, ransacking homes, and generally profiting off the outbreak.
So he writes this, and of course, you know, Richard Allen and Absalom Jones are incensed that, I mean, Allen's like, I almost lost my life in this, and we've watched other people die. And so this causes Richard Allen and Absalom Jones to write a pamphlet in reply.
They talk about what they had seen and experienced, how in one instance they were passing by the home of a man, and he said, if you come back here again, I will kill you. And only a few days later, he dies of the fever, and they end up having to go to his house to take him to the burial ground.
This is actually the first copyrighted pamphlet by African-American authors in the country's history.
An amazing feat, because what they believed, you know, then, and I still believe it today, is that you can say what you want, but if it's not written, it didn't happen.
When the yellow fever epidemic finally ended in November of 1793, about 5,000 people in Philadelphia had died. And still, nobody knew what had started this deadly outbreak. It took more than 100 years after the epidemic for scientists to finally resolve what caused yellow fever and how it spread. It wasn't the rotting coffee.
So the infection is spread through the bite of the Aedes aegypti mosquito. The mosquito takes a blood meal, ingests the virus, and then at a second blood meal for another person, infects another person.
That's Drexel University infectious disease specialist Esther Chernak.
We tend to see belts of yellow fever in South America and in sub-Saharan Africa.
In 1793, the infected mosquitoes must have gotten to Philadelphia on ships coming from far away, warmer climates. And they made themselves right at home.
The Aedes aegypti mosquito is very, very good at breeding in small containers, small collections of water.
We know that bleeding, purging, and cold baths don't fight yellow fever. But today, there's still no cure when the illness strikes.
There is no specific anti-yellow fever medication, so once someone has it, there's really not much that can be done.
But a vaccine became available in the 1930s. Benjamin Rush and his colleagues in Philadelphia's medical community never considered that it was mosquitoes transmitting yellow fever. Here's historian David Barnes again.
Had anyone proposed in 1793 that mosquitoes were responsible for yellow fever, I think it would have been not only ridiculed at the time, but actually ridiculous. It's a crazy theory because from a simple standpoint of empirical observation and correlation, mosquitoes are always here in the summer. They're always everywhere in the summer.
But yellow fever wasn't. They also just knew nothing about viruses and how they spread. When the yellow fever epidemic of 1793 was over, many remembered Benjamin Rush for the tireless care he tried to provide.
He is elevated because he's become this hero, because he lived through yellow fever and all this, but he also is much more of a target.
That's historian Stephen Fried. Rush made some powerful political enemies during the epidemic by suggesting that the fever was spread through the dirt and filth in Philadelphia's streets, and by insisting on his heavy-handed treatments of bleeding and purging.
John Adams actually has to give him a job, a make-work job, at the U.S. Mint so that he has enough money because he's afraid that Rush won't be able to practice anymore.
But at the same time, Rush was still influential.
He was making American medical education matter.
So, Michael, in terms of public health, what were the big lessons of this yellow fever epidemic? What happened in the aftermath?
Well, the most important thing to happen in the wake of the 1793 epidemic and the epidemics that hit later that decade was that the city finally began to create an infrastructure to deal with public health threats like yellow fever. Here's historian David Barnes.
The city created a Board of Health. Beginning in 1794, the Board of Health met regularly and was responsible primarily for avoiding a repeat of 1793.
The board was supposed to clean up the city and prevent threats from coming in. Eventually, the Philadelphia Lazaretto, a quarantine station for ships entering our port, opened in 1801. Philadelphia's water supply would also see important improvements. And within a decade, Philadelphia became the first city in the country to develop its own municipal water supply.
Outbreak 1793 is a production of The Pulse at WHYY in Philadelphia, a weekly health and science podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced and sound designed by Mike and Scott of WHYY with Michael Udell of Drexel University. Emily Pontecorvo contributed reporting. Voice acting by Aldine Banks and Jim Barton. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Mixing by Charlie Kyer. Web production by Lindsay Lazarski.